All right, we're going to be on the record in 89709. As both parties are aware, each side has 17 minutes for argument. The first 2 minutes will be uninterrupted. Do you wish to save time for rebuttal? 3 minutes. Okay. All right, and you can begin when you're ready, sir.
Your Honors, John Hacker for the petitioners. We have petitioned for mandamus relief on three threshold immunities. The first is lack of personal jurisdiction, because a universally accessible website or app generally is not purposefully directed at any given state. The fact that residents of a given state choose to connect with the platform does not suffice to subject it to personal jurisdiction there. The contacts cited by the state here do not suffice either. They're both far too sporadic and unrelated to the claims the state asserts. Next, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act provides a threshold immunity that protects online platforms from liability for harms allegedly caused by their decisions about whether and how to publish third-party content. Here, the state challenges design features that select which third-party videos to display and to determine how to display them. Every relevant authority, Your Honors, defines publishing as selecting which content to include in a compilation and how to display that content. There's thus no answer to say that the state is just challenging the platform's own acts because they result in a mix of video content that is allegedly addictive to users who view the content. In Lemon and other cases cited by the state, the platform's own acts allegedly caused harm without any videos being published or viewed. Here, by contrast, the state's theory depends on users viewing the published content. The rule is quite simple. When viewing published third-party content is essential to the alleged harm, the platform's publication decisions are protected by Section 230. Finally, any publisher's decisions about whether and how to publish third-party speech are also protected by the First Amendment because they are inherently expressive. A magazine editor's choices about which articles to publish and how to display them gives that magazine its own expressive character. The same is true for TikTok's publication decisions, which make its platform unique. Its content and its look differ from Facebook's, from Snapchat's, and so on. If the state prevails, the platform will change significantly. Each user will see different content in a different order, and so on. The state's claims thus directly seek to alter TikTok's expression, which the First Amendment forbids.
Counsel, just in terms of the jurisdictional question, I'm looking at the Mavericks and UBID versus GoDaddy cases where there's, you know, something more than just passive website presence. I understand that's not enough. But there is also, in the Mavericks case, with the national viewership and scope appeals and profits from an audience in a particular state. So here the allegation is that there was particular targeting towards Nevada. There were billboards in Las Vegas and up north, that there was data that was aggregated and taken from Nevada users, which exceeds a million users, to have specific content targeted to their geographic location, and there was profit from that. So how does that not get us to the Mavericks and UBID GoDaddy?
So I think I need to separate out the two sort of contacts that you alluded to. The one is the fact that there are lots of users in Nevada, which is just another way of saying the harm is experienced in Nevada, and that's not enough under Bergauer and Tricarici, because those users, no targeting of those users, they're reaching out of the state to connect with a universally accessible platform. It's not the kind of targeting that's required by those cases and many others. The other contacts you mentioned are closer to a version of something where a decision was made to do something in Nevada, but there the contacts are way too sporadic, and they're not related to the state's claim. Look at the billboards. They only cite two billboards, and the ones they cite involve greeting cards.
But it's just minimum contacts at this stage, right? We just have to make a prima facie showing. So it's not the same as going to trial and having a preponderance of evidence. We just need to make a basic prima facie finding a minimum contacts, which is a very low threshold.
Well, I'll fight the hypothetical, I guess, or fight the question, which is not that low a threshold. Yes, it's prima facie, and yes, it's minimum, but by minimum context doesn't mean like the least amount of context. It means a minimum that due process requires. And here, compare this case to the Ford Motor case that they rely on. In Ford, the court cited four categories of contacts that it referred to as a truckload of contacts. There were 36 dealers in the case in Montana. There was a resale market that the court that the that Ford was trying to develop there. They said that the court said that Ford had in every way imaginable tried to encourage the purchase of Ford trucks through ads, TV ads, radio ads, print ads, and direct mail. None of that's present here. There's nothing like that. If it were just enough, as the state sort of suggests, for a nationwide business to do business in a given state on the same terms it does business everywhere and be appealing to a number of state residents, the court wouldn't have had to go through those very specific contacts and explain why that all put together was the kind of context that satisfied the due process minimum.
Well, counsel, would you address then the recent Briskin versus Shopify case out of the Ninth Circuit?
So yes, in that case involved importantly different facts. Now we do think, to be clear, that it was incorrectly decided and that Judge Callahan has the better analysis. I urge the court to look at Judge Callahan's explanation, but it's still a different case in a meaningful way. In that case, the defendant was secretly placing cookies onto phones and then taking the data secretly through the cookie out of the state. So the defendant there, digitally at least, was reaching into the state and actually literally putting something on your phone. It's a little data file that changes the user's phone. Nothing like that is going on here. It's just a passively available website, available universally, that residents anywhere on the same terms can choose to reach out and connect with servers, which are not alleged to be in the state of Nevada. So it's different in that way.
But isn't there at least the position of the state and some evidence presented that there is specific data being gathered as to use in Nevada and advertisers being able to specifically direct their ads toward Nevadans? And at least under the analysis in that case, isn't that enough? Like, it doesn't have to be, oh, Nevada is the only place we want to be. It doesn't have to be reaching out differently than to other states, as long as there is something specific indicating they're wanting and intentionally doing business in Nevada.
I understand. I think that's why the factual difference I described matters, because the court is saying that in the context of when a platform is reaching out into lots of states and inserting and reaching out to a particular state or all states to, into the state to put something, in that case, on your phones. It's different when you just have a universally accessible website. People reach out to the website, and yes, data is collected in the same way it is everywhere on the same terms. There isn't any targeting or alleged targeting of, Nevada residents. There's no allegation that the TikTok defendant said, we really need to build up our presence in Nevada. Here's what we're going to do.
Are there advertisers who specifically direct to Nevada users?
Not TikTok. The due process analysis is about the defendant's acts purposefully directing what the defendant is doing in the state, and the fact that third parties not associated with the defendant can do targeted advertisements does not establish.
So
that
TikTok collects money from advertisers who are paying them to advertise to Nevada users.
In the same way, on the same terms it does throughout the country. There's no TikTok as a defendant has not purposefully availed itself. It's allowed third parties to do that. If I could turn to the other two issues, a lot to cover in our short time.
Just briefly, before we leave the jurisdictional piece, is there any state then that TikTok's doing business in?
Well, so first of all, there's the general jurisdiction, wherever the headquarters, California would be the obvious one. And then, contrary to what the state is saying, it's not that a platform, a generally accessible platform, can't purposefully avail itself of jurisdiction anywhere. TikTok or any other platform could do things, could make the kind of decision I was talking about to say we need to build up our user presence in a given state. And there are states where TikTok has done things where we're not asserting personal jurisdiction defense because design decisions, wherever the platform design decisions are made in that state, we've chosen not to argue jurisdiction because there's a good argument that conduct is TikTok inserting itself in the state and doing suit-related business there. So on Section 230, if I can turn to that one, the test, of course, is whether liability in a given case is based on platform, that's the first one, not contested, acting as a publisher of third-party content. That's the publisher is the second prong, and third-party content is the third prong. The third prong is about whether the publisher, the publishing acts involve third-party content, not the publisher's, not the platform's own content. And it works, therefore, to avoid this problem of having a but-for immunity. That is not our position. It never has been. It doesn't make any sense, because under Barnes, what it's saying is you can't just say you're a publisher and say, then therefore we win, we have immunity, because the liability has to arise from you publishing third-party content. It's narrow in that sense. It's broad within that sphere. It's incredibly important. And there has to be a broad understanding of what publishing is and third-party content, but it doesn't go beyond that. And so the core principle is that Section 230 applies to the breach of a duty derived from the defendant's status or conduct as publisher. And when the harm is derived from viewing third-party content that the platform has chosen to publish, that duty is allegedly violated. So the two questions are, first, is it publishing? And obviously publishing here, because selecting third-party content is publishing, even if the selections are made through an algorithm.
But don't the allegations of the state here go beyond just putting out something that somebody else wrote, right? I mean, one of the allegations is that the coin system and the way that you, I'm not even going to say that because that's going to show my age and inexperience, but the way that popularity is shown on an account, I mean, those are functions of the platform, not functions of a third party.
So not quite, Your Honor. This is the key. They are publication decisions about what content and how to, what content to display and how to display it. And the harm, everything they say, the core of the case is addiction harm, that all of the, that the algorithm selection of videos are too engaging, and that the other features work to get users overly engaged in watching videos. But that's the key. That's the difference from cases like Lemon and all the other cases. The harm exists, the alleged harm exists, only because the publication decisions result in viewing,
but
which is said to be harmful.
The option of a coin, for instance, that you can buy and then post to somebody else's account to show that you like them,
right,
and the parental functions and the social manipulation tools, are these not like the speed filters that were addressed in Lemon?
I'm so glad you asked the question, because they're exactly not, right? That's critical to the whole proposition here, because Lemon is the archetypal case of when a platform's own acts cause harm without any publication. There was no publication in Lemon because the speed filters caused harm, were alleged to have caused harm in the creation of the videos by encouraging creators to make dangerous videos. And then harms happened when they made them. They never had to be published, and indeed weren't published. It didn't matter. There's no viewing. Here, it's critically different. The harm exists only because of the decisions the platform makes about which videos to display and how to display them. Those are publication decisions.
Counsel, hasn't the state arguing that it's not about that? It's about the addiction to the continuous scrolling for hours on the platform, and it's not about which specific, at least the claims that they are actually asserting aren't about the specific viewing of this video that was harmful or that one that was harmful.
If I can add to your question, consistent continuous scrolling of what? It's videos that they're watching.
Okay.
And videos are too, they're too
of
engaging.
Any videos.
Of any videos. It's not, but 230 doesn't say immunity only applies to specific or particular third-party content. It says any content. The harm, my whole point is, yes, they're saying the features are harmful. I get that. But they're only harmful because of the videos that are selected. If they win, think about what happens if they win, Your Honors. If they win, the TikTok app, each user's app is going to look completely different. There will be different content on it. Each user will open it up and won't see.
Why does there have to be different content just if it's not a continuous scroll or if the video doesn't automatically start playing?
They're alleging all of these as a package, but even if you focused in isolation, had the exact same videos that were just as engaging as the current ones, I'm sure the state would not be happy about that.
Right.
If they were to concede that and say, look, we won't make TikTok change the content that's selected,
right.
That's still a publication decision because it's still going to look very different to the user, right? It's a completely different experience. Does it have to be longer?
Are there cases under the CDA saying not as to selection about which videos to allow or not to allow, but instead as to these sorts of things, that those are in fact publishing within the meaning of the CDA?
So two sets of cases. First is Angelilli, a recent decision from the Illinois court. That was about a video game, an algorithm and features that selected video games. The allegation was not that any particular video games were addictive. The allegation was that the person was harmed because he became addicted to just using video games because of the variety. The platform gave him just too much variety. He couldn't put his, you know, games down. He just loved all of them because there were so many of them. He didn't want to miss out. Exact same allegation made here. And then I would say cases like MP, Grindr, Force, all of those actually are about the design features, not the content. Although they say, well, you know, in Force it was terrorist content and in MP it was racist content. But the allegation was not that the content itself was actionable, right? The content itself was lawful, not, you know, it was objectionable, but not unlawful. The problem allegedly was the way in which the features operated to feed content to the plaintiff or the bad perpetrator, and so that which ultimately caused harm, right? So it was the way the platform was selecting videos resulting in a feed that was harmful. It's exactly the same allegation that's an issue here.
Are you and I'm going to give you an extra 2.5 minutes, and we'll add an extra 2.5
Thanks.
Minutes.
Thank you.
Are you taking the position that the content has to in and of itself be harmful for the state to succeed on its claims, or that they can succeed on otherwise unharmful individual videos that are collectively put together in a way to cause
harm? It's completely the latter, right? Their argument is the content in and of itself has to be harmful, but that wasn't true in any of these cases. The content in and of itself wasn't the problem. It was the feed, the way it was put together by the platform. And our argument absolutely is, and you can just apply the straight rule that I think exists under 230. Does the state's claim of liability seek to establish that the platform, liability based on the platform's publication decisions about what third-party content to display and how to display it? It doesn't matter in that sense what the specific content is. It's a set of choices that puts together a feed that for some users or many users is said to be harmful. The feed is third-party content.
But the state is alleging that some of what you're doing is originated with you, for example, changing the image of the user in a way that is more attractive. That is generated allegedly by you and is causing addictive and psychologically damaging behavior. That's one of their allegations. I'm not fluent in this.
Yeah, no, I understand. So the answer is, again, not quite. They don't allege, and they couldn't allege because it's just not true. We don't put the filter on. It's a tool available to creators when they're creating their videos if they want to use a filter. It's like giving an author a pen or a typewriter. It's just a way for creators to create their third-party content. So it's facilitating the publication of third-party content, and therefore it's just.
But where
another,
does that originate from?
Well, it's our. I mean, we give them the filter, but we're not publishing the filter. We don't do any publishing, so it doesn't fit within Barnes 3, which asks whether or not you're publishing your own content. We don't publish a filter. We give a creator a filter to publish their own content. So it doesn't fit. It's definitely publication under part two, Barnes two, and it's not our own content under part three.
And so we have very little time left, but I wanted to give you the opportunity to talk about the misrepresentation omission claims and the First Amendment.
Thank you.
And that's a lot to chew in a very short period of time, but I'd like to hear your take on those in light of the briefing by the other side.
Understood. Let me just get to the First Amendment, and I'll address the misrepresentation claims sort of under both that and the 230. So the First Amendment, the basic point comes from Moody, which says, deciding on the third-party speech that will be included or excluded from a compilation and then organizing and presenting it, the included items, is expressive activity of its own. And you can see that in how the TikTok platform looks on your phone. I mean, it looks a certain way. It looks different from Facebook and Snapchat. That's what's expressive about it. The state actually concedes this critical premise. In their brief at page 48, they refer to the, quote, the otherwise protected activity of creating an edited compilation of others' expressive content. They recognize that creating an edited compilation of third-party speech as protected activity. And they correctly described Moody.
But Moody was a case that explicitly sought to force platforms to change the mix of third-party speech in Florida and Texas, whereas here the state claims do not similarly seek to force TikTok to exclude or display more third-party content expressing a certain political or ideological view. Instead, they're alleging the design element claims focus on TikTok's allegedly content neutral addictive features. So how do you reconcile that?
So two related points. Moody is not limited to state regulation of expressive speech. It's based on politics. And that, of course, would be absurd. The First Amendment isn't limited to just, you know, choosing between Democrats and Republicans. It's about expression. And what Moody says is what I said, and what the state agrees, is that when somebody edits a compilation of third-party speech and presents it to the world, that's expressive. That's protected by the First Amendment. I get that that doesn't answer the question, but it's at least that key premise. It's protected. And you're right. The state says, and they correctly read Moody as saying it's about state regulation seeking to, quote, correct the mix of third-party content. The state says we're not trying to do that, but I don't understand that. Of course they are, Your Honor. That's exactly what this whole case is about, is that the TikTok platform for each user has the wrong mix of third-party content. They want the third-party content to be different. That's the whole problem with the algorithm, right? The algorithm is selecting videos and putting them in an order that's too engaging and been playing them for too long. They want a different mix of content. They want different choices about what third-party content is displayed to viewers, and they want different choices about what order to put it in so that you don't, you know, they've got the whole story about the dopamine when a certain, you know, a video you don't like comes up and you jump to the next video. They want that to stop. That's the mix of content, right? It's absolutely exactly
so. Counsel, footnote 5 of the Moody decision explicitly says that they don't deal with feeds whose algorithms respond solely to how users act online, giving them the content they appear to want without regard to independent content standards. So it seems that United States Supreme Court was distinguishing those type of algorithms from the actual platform selection, saying these things are not appropriate to publish.
So two points. First of all, they were just saying we weren't addressing it, right? Because Justice Barrett said, right. But they weren't saying it doesn't apply to that. They just said we weren't reaching right. it. The analysis, though, what the court says is that choosing what to display and not to display is expression, and the state seems to agree with that. And of course, it's incredibly expressive because the message being sent to users is come to this platform to find material, third-party videos that you're most likely to find engaging. And importantly, it says to creators, those who are actually creating the material, publish your material on our platform because we're going to find for you the audience most likely to engage with your material. That's what a publisher does, and that's incredibly expressive. Here's what the Angelilli Court I mentioned earlier says about this. The First Amendment applies to algorithm-selected videos when the algorithm is, quote, developed by humans and generated words and image its human creators intended, such that the platform performs exactly how the human operators had designed to perform. The algorithm is a choice. It's a publication choice, an expressive choice about what you want the feed for each user to look like. And we know it's expressive because if you pull up TikTok and look at that feed, it's going to have different content, make a different set of choices about the videos you'll see than the Facebook app or the Snapchat app. Those are all expressive, different expressive choices. Now, I haven't answered your question about the deception claims. Okay, I understand.
Way over time. So I'm going to give you an extra minute and a half. I should have anticipated there would be more questions after I said 2.5 minutes. So you'll get a minute and a half of rebuttal, which means we're adding 7.5 minutes to response.
And when you're addressing the misrepresentation and omission claims, counsel, can you just explain why this is not on all fours with the Bride case?
With?
The Bride, B-R-I-D-E.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. I'll do that on rebuttal.
Okay, question? That's fine. Well,
is that what you're suggesting, Your Honor? Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, this seems very similar to Bride to me, so.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Michael Gayen of Claggett and Sykes on behalf of Real Party and Interest, the state of Nevada. I listened closely to the court's questions. I'd like to start, though, with the Third Circuit's decision, recent decision in Anderson versus TikTok over this same platform. And that was a Section 230 decision, but the Anderson court found that Section 230 did not apply because it referenced the Moody court's holding that a platform's curation of content is protected first-party speech. Based on that conclusion from Moody, that means such conduct, quote, amounts to first-party speech under Section 232. And the Anderson court actually quoted Justice Thomas from a recent dissent in a case against Snap. And Justice Thomas said, in the platform's world, they are fully responsible for their websites when it results in constitutional protections, the First Amendment. But the moment that responsibility could lead to liability, they can disclaim any obligations and enjoy greater protections from suit than nearly any other industry. That's Section 230. So they are trying to block all liability. First Amendment protects first-party speech, TikTok's own speech. Section 230 protects only third-party speech. And the state's case does not involve, as the district court found in great detail after a long hearing and significant briefing, this case by the state does not involve first-party or third-party speech at all. It involves content-neutral design elements that TikTok intentionally put into its platform with full knowledge of their addictive properties for children for the express purpose of addicting children, also full well knowing the mental health risks and harms to children from those very design elements. And on top of that, I heard Justice Lee ask about misrepresentations. This case is about affirmative misrepresentations and material omissions under the Nevada Deceptive Trade Practices Act and the authority of the Attorney General of the State of Nevada to enforce its laws in its own state. So I hope that resolves Section 230 and the First Amendment. I do have some other comments. I'm happy to answer a question about it, but I feel like from the court's questions that I heard, there are a lot of questions about personal jurisdiction. And in my review of this court's case law, I have not seen this court have an opportunity to address Ford Motor Company from the U.S. Supreme Court head on. And the Briskin versus Shopify decision from the Ninth Circuit just a couple of months ago, obviously this court has not addressed that. But what this case offers is this court decides to take on this particular writ petition, finds it appropriate, the state's case against TikTok is essentially Ford Motor Company, a global or nationwide company, overlaid with Briskin, a digital company. So it is a lot like Briskin, but the fact pattern is the same. And I heard Justice Lee ask about Mavericks, and I'm very glad that you did. Before I get to Mavericks, I'd like to clear the air because in the briefing, and I didn't hear it too much today, but in the briefing, TikTok says the effects test under Calder and Tricarci apply here, and the district court erred because it did not apply the effects test. The effects test does not apply here. And it was actually shocking in the briefing that TikTok cited the Bergauer case repeatedly, but did not disclose the holding right up front. And I believe that was an en banc decision. Right up front in the decision, the holding is, we conclude that the effects test applies in intentional torts. This case is not an intentional tort case. The effects test is typically in defamation, fraud, other sorts of intentional torts. Bergauer was breach of fiduciary duty by a trustee. And the court there held that that sounded an intentional tort because of the specific allegations in that case. This case is not an intentional tort case. The effects test does not apply under Bergauer, Tricarci, Calder.
Can you explain that? Sorry. Isn't it effectively, I mean, I realize the claims that we're dealing with are under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. Are you saying claims under that act are not intentional torts? For this purpose?
Yes, that statutory claim, I do not believe there's any case law that would support finding those claims sound in intentional tort. The state also has it at this stage. I know it's not before this court, but subsequent district court proceedings on the second amended complaint, which is the last document in the appendix, And then there was a subsequent round of motion to dismiss briefing and decisions, and the district court has allowed the product defect, negligence, and unjust enrichment claims to go forward as well. Those do not sound an intentional tort.
So you're saying the misrepresentation claims, you don't categorize those as intentional tort claims?
Well, it depends. I think it would depend, and maybe on a summary judgment record, we might have enough. But the allegations right now are just that and one of the specific design elements that the state is challenging, I believe it's number 6 in the complaint, is that there's ineffective and misleading parental controls and well-being initiatives. So,
but you're saying there are affirmative misrepresentations that are actionable. Wouldn't that qualify as an intentional tort?
Well, we'd have to do discovery to figure out the intent and show it. And that's why I said, I think on this record, it's hard to say that it's an intentional tort. And I don't think this court has ever said a Deceptive Trade Practices Act cause of action with a broad brush sounds an intentional tort. And I believe that would be an inaccurate holding. And we haven't really briefed that here. And that's why I don't think relief is appropriate on this record at a motion to dismiss stage. And before I move along, I would like to point out that we are at the pleadings stage, and the district court was required to apply 12b2. The prima facie showing is all that's needed, and that is a very low standard. It just means at first glance, at first impression. And here, if you look at the record in the state's opposition, we had mounds of evidence from a pre-suit investigation that many states coordinated on against TikTok. And there are dozens of TikTok documents attached to the declaration of Mr. Kruger, who's here today in court, from that investigation and the billboards. And I'll get to those in a second. That's very different than any of the other fact patterns that we've seen. That is intentional reaching out to the state and placing those billboards. And I'm confident that when we do discovery, we will find more contacts like that. And that's why this record, we have made our prima facie showing. Let's go do discovery and see how many more contacts there really are and work, because it's not a final.
Can I just redirect your attention to the CPA, the CBA, sorry, immunity. So under the Barnes test, right, so the question is whether the state's causes of action seek to treat TikTok in this instance as a publisher of information provided by third-party users such that immunity would apply. And then we jump to cases like DIROF, recommendations and notifications are not content in and of themselves. And then we turn to the In Re social media adolescent addiction case, which held things like ephemeral content is editorial in nature. Algorithms are not content in and of themselves, but tools to display third-party content, which is traditional publisher functions. And so what I'm having a problem with is with all of the different functionalities that are available on TikTok, which I learned about in the context of this case. You have the low friction variables, the social manipulation, ephemeral content, push notification filters, parental controls. Should we be looking at those type of functionalities differently, or are you categorically saying that those are all not editorial functions such that the 230 would not apply? Because some of it is a discretion in terms of how the content is published, when it's published, with which frequency, how long to keep it up. And those have historically, by the case law, shown that those are all editorial functions. So yes. How does it survive the immunity?
It survives the immunity for a number of reasons. First, we are at the pleading stage. I heard a lot of factual discussion, both in the questions and in the answers, when the petitioner was here speaking. And these types of detailed factual questions are very interesting for discovery. But at the pleading stage, the state has alleged and actually expressly disclaimed that it is seeking to hold TikTok liable for any content. This is in paragraphs 178 to 180 of the Second Amended complaint. And the district court also, and I don't believe Judge Kishner relied solely on that disclaimer, but Judge Kishner reached the conclusion that the state was not seeking TikTok liable for any content. And the state's disclaimer of liability on content says TikTok could publish any videos it wanted, even if the state were to prevail in this action. There is no limitation on the content. The state is not talking about the content. We are focused on specific design features. And I'm glad you brought up In Re Social Media, that case, because I believe one problem there that, and the pleading stage, I do not believe it is allowed or appropriate to carve up an individual cause of action under Rule 12B. You either have to throw out the entire cause of action or not. Under Rule 56C, there you can come in and target pieces and take it out. But under Rule 12B5, you cannot say, well, this one thing, part of your cause of action. And the state has six discrete causes of action, and none of them is limited to a specific design feature. It is broadly challenging. Each cause of action is broadly challenging the existence of these intentional design functionalities that TikTok put on there to addict children and make billions of dollars off of these people.
But counsel, doesn't that, as they argue, right, I guess respond to the argument they make that the harm that comes from that, and a lot of the discussion, even in the rather lengthy complaint, is about the content that these young people are actually watching, about self-harm or bad diet or unrealistic physical appearance and the like. So how can you say it's not about the content?
Because it doesn't matter what content is displayed. It could be about puppies or kittens or anything. It could be watching food videos. The problem is these design elements encourage compulsive use in children, and they are expressly designed, and TikTok has done internal studies, and they know the weaknesses of developing children's brains, and they are specifically designed these functionalities to exploit those and create compulsive use among young people.
So when you talk about the blackout challenge and drug use and sexual exploitation and all of those things, that's just kind of an ancillary argument to the addictive functionality of TikTok, because the complaint does mention these type of content specific harms that are falling upon the young people in Nevada.
Yes, those examples are in the complaint, no doubt about it, and content certainly is delivered via some, and I want to get to that, only some of these design elements actually have any content remotely related to them. But yes, those are simply examples in the discussion in the complaint to give context to what we're talking about. Of course, TikTok is a platform that provides content, but how does it provide the content? And what are the design elements? And we talked about low friction variable rewards. I won't get into all of that, but that is a well-known tactic for exploiting human behaviors that TikTok has taken advantage of.
Well, counsel, isn't like there's a whole claim, I believe, in the complaint that focuses on alleged misrepresentations and omissions, and that is about whether in fact they've made it safe and whether they allow videos encouraging self-harm or suicide. And so to address that claim, don't you have to consider the content of the videos?
Well, as to the you have to consider the content, but only in relation to the misrepresentations. Were they false, misleading? Did they materially omit something from the representations about the safety of their platform? So yes, you are looking at content to frame whether something was true or false that TikTok said, but this court has held under Irwin v. State that the state can regulate commercial speech, and there is no right under the First Amendment or any other provision of the Constitution to have misleading commercial speech. That is just the law. United States Supreme Court, that's the Associated Press case, and then this court, this is in our answering brief, page 51, cites Irwin v. State, that the state may freely regulate misleading commercial speech. And so there is no issue with the state challenging what we have alleged to be misleading statements to the public about the safety of the TikTok platform. And this is in the Second Amended Complaint, appendix page 958, paragraph 230. TikTok's statement on youth safety and well-being claims that TikTok does not put young people at risk of developmental harm, close quote, and quote, provides young people with an experience that is developmentally appropriate. The state challenges those statements as being false. That's part of what this case is about. And so then we can go look at actual content and is this developmentally appropriate? But these are questions for discovery and experts.
So even if there isn't First Amendment protection, how does the CDA Section 230 interplay with that?
Well, first of all, on First Amendment, I would say there is no First Amendment protection on misleading commercial speech. But the Section 230, Section 230 would not apply at all to TikTok's own statements, because Section 230 only immunizes certain liability based on third-party speech or content. Mm-hmm. And the state is not challenging. The state is not saying TikTok should take down the suicide different challenges that it has that are causing harm. There are individual lawsuits that are doing that around the country, but this case is not about that. It is about particular design features that are intended to force or encourage compulsive use. One design feature the state is challenging, and this is appendix page 934 to 936, is push notifications. That has nothing to do with content. What a push notification is when we're sitting here, and we haven't heard one yet, but somebody's phone buzzes when they're not even on the platform. You're not even engaging with TikTok's platform, but TikTok reaches out to this state, and I bet in discovery we'll find millions of push notifications sent to children and others in this state to support personal jurisdiction. But these push notifications are just buzzing your phone, these haptic things where it vibrates or dings, interrupts, whatever you're doing. And instead of listening in class, the kids pick up their phones and start looking at TikTok videos again because they want you back on that platform. Maybe second someone is on the platform.
But what about the other design element claims that Moody tells us are choices about how to enforce a platform's community standards and content moderation rules? So that would include things like its algorithms, its ephemeral content, endless scroll, and other features that bear on how third-party content is displayed on a user's feed. Is that not expressive speech?
No, it is not. And I do not believe Moody addressed any of these particular design functionalities. But even if endless
scroll... Well, it talked about First Amendment. It didn't talk about 230 at all, actually. But it talked about the First Amendment. So that's what. So now I'm moving you into the First Amendment argument. So those are, how are those not expressive speech? When TikTok decides how often they're going to push things out, whether or not they're going to put things at the top of your feed, if they're going to keep things that, like the live feed is only available during the live portion of it and then it goes away. The endless scroll features. I mean, those not editorial functions that are subject to the First Amendment, free speech?
No, those are design elements built into the platform intended to take advantage of children's fear of missing out or FOMO. And this is a very real driver of teen behavior, is the fear of missing out. And this,
but it can be both, right? It can be protected by the First Amendment and still have a consequential, unintended consequence or intentional consequence, whatever the case may be, that kids may become more addicted to it. But is that not still First Amendment protected speech in terms of how you organize the data on your platform?
No, I do not believe so, Your Honor. And I would direct the court's attention to the Turner Broadcasting case from the U.S. Supreme Court in the 1980s. There was a federal statute that required cable TV providers to carry local broadcasting stations. And the Supreme Court said that that was unrelated to the content of expression disseminated by cable and broadcast speakers. That to me, that fact situation is far closer to, I mean, they forced cable companies to carry the speech of local broadcast companies that the cable companies did not want to do. And the U.S. Supreme Court said that was fine. It passed intermediate scrutiny, which just, you need to have a legitimate state interest in protecting something that is, you all know the standards, I don't know why I'm saying it, but intermediate scrutiny. And under Turner Broadcasting, that federal statute requiring companies to carry others' content. They said that was content neutral. So now we're here with TikTok, and they are trying to shoehorn the state's design element claims, or they're really just allegations, because the causes of action are separate and apart and touch essentially all of these design elements in one form or another. And like I said, Rule 12b-5 is not the vehicle to split up a cause of action and attack an allegation. That's for summary judgment. And that's why these sorts of things, and a lot of the questions from the court, are very fact intensive, and I don't even understand them all right now. I have co-counsel who understand them far better than me, and I'm sure we'll have experts who understand them a lot better. And those are the types of things and facts that will be presented to the district court, likely under Rule 56, after discovery, and there will be a much more fulsome record for this court to understand these things and have the state's causes of action framed by facts and evidence instead of just allegations at this point.
So this is a content neutral complaint. What is the remedy that you're seeking for TikTok to change without changing the content itself?
Well, first, the state is seeking to have TikTok be honest with the public about what it knows about these design features and the harms that they cause to young people, so that parents can make informed decisions about whether and to what extent to allow their children to even use the TikTok platform. So that's, I think, one thing. And the others are to make certain highly addictive design elements that are targeting children not available to children in the state of Nevada. And the state of Nevada is not the only state pursuing these types of claims. It's obvious from the record that they're being pursued in federal and state courts around the country right now. So Nevada is not alone in seeking change for children in this particular space. One thing before I run out of time, I see I've got 2 minutes left. I did want to touch on Justice Lee's question or comment about Mavericks. And I think it is important, if the court were to tackle personal jurisdiction in this case and address Ford Motor Company and Briskin v. Shopify in the context of this case and these allegations. Briskin at page 26 quotes the Cybercell case from 1997. And Briskin has a very good historical recounting of specific personal jurisdiction in the internet age, starting in the late 90s and through to the present. But they recognize from Cybercell two considerations for digital companies in terms of purposeful availment. First, contacts with the forum state could be in the form of electronic contacts. And second, the something more than a passive website, I believe as Justice Lee acknowledged, than mere passive nationwide accessibility is required to show express aiming. But here's what's important from Mavericks, and this is the Briskin decision at 31, quotes Mavericks. It says, and this is an excellent rule statement for this case, where a website with national viewership and scope appeals to and profits from an audience in a particular state, the site's operators can be said to have expressly aimed at that state. That ends it here for TikTok. They appeal to and profit from the residents of the state of Nevada. They run billboards here. The state attached to its opposition documentation from Apple for the Apple iStore. There's millions of dollars in in-app purchases made by Nevadans on the TikTok app. They're extracting dollars directly from Nevada through those users. Briskin pages 29 and 30 identify factors for the courts to consider online platforms and in the context of purposeful availment. And I'm happy to answer any of the questions. I see I'm short on time.
Is this the functionalities you're talking about? Is this can you just address briefly whether or not this is a neutral tool as described in roommates.com and from the Ninth Circuit? Are you familiar?
Neutral tool. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Whether or not the design features are simply a neutral tool.
They are not a neutral tool. These are driven by TikTok's desire to addict children. I mean, it's content neutral, but the features all exist for the sole purpose of maximizing engagement by children and addicting them. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Your Honors. I promised I would answer the deception, and I still promise, but I have to start with Anderson. I was amazed the counsel cited it. In their brief, they said they weren't relying on it, and I understand why. Because Anderson explicitly says that an algorithm's choices about curation are protected by the First Amendment. Anderson holds that it's expressive activity. It says, given the Supreme Court's observations that platforms engage in protected first-party speech under the First Amendment when they curate compilations of others' content via their expressive algorithms, and it goes on to explain that, in that court's view, because it was expressive, it was first-party speech and not encompassed by Section 230. I completely agree with their case that the algorithm is a curation that's expressive and protected by the First Amendment. Where I disagree with Anderson is the fact that just because it's expressive, that doesn't mean it's not publishing. Of course it's publishing, and therefore it is protected by the Section 230, unlike Anderson. I do not believe it does, but as Angelilli points out, it's humans that design the algorithm and run it, and humans decide if it's not doing the job that the humans want it to do, that it's not giving a display and providing users the feed that the humans want the feed to look like, you know, that maybe they're falling behind another algorithm or another platform which is more successful, then the humans will say, well, we better change the algorithm, that kind of thing, right? The humans control the algorithm. The algorithm does the job that humans would do at traditional print media. It just does it at scale, faster and better, but it's absolutely curation of content, which is what's protected by Moody. I do want to say a word about the misrepresentations. I keep promising that. So Bride is explained in Grindr. I'm asking to exceed just to answer this question the justice had. Bride is explained in Grindr, which says that's a specific promise about unmasking harassers, which is unconnected to publishing video content. Remember, that's our rule. If the liability comes from publishing third-party content, the harm is from viewing that. That's the problem. Grindr says Bride isn't about that. Grindr does say Section 230 does not apply to general statements about safety, just that our platform is safe, because that's just the same thing as attack on the platform's design choices themselves. That's what this case is about. Design choices. No, it's not about specific content. It's just exactly what counsel said in his argument. What counsel said in his argument is that it's about how does it provide the content. Exactly. It's about how the publication's decisions result in content that they say ends up addicting users. It can't happen without viewing the content. So it's liability derived from publishing third-party content, which means Section 230 applies and the First Amendment applies as well, because that's an expressive choice. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. All right. Thank all of you. There's a lot of